Erev Shabbat Shalom. Parshat Emor, Lag BaOmer. I had originally thought to discuss something in the Parsha today with a brief look at connection to Lag BaOmer, but unfortunately, in light of the tragedy that took place yesterday in Meron, I had to scrap my original ideas. And I'd like to connect the Parsha, to a certain degree, to what happened last night. Obviously, it's too soon. 45 people were killed under horrible circumstances when they went simply to celebrate and to have a religious moment. It's too early to really analyze, and as we learned a few weeks ago in the Parsha, in the wake of tragedy, sometimes the answer is Vayidom Maharon. The only thing we can do is be silent. So I'm not going to pretend to say anything smart about that part. In fact, my mother, may she rest in peace, always used to say that when it comes to things like that, nobody's smart. In fact, we all realize our own inadequacies. But what I do want to talk about is the concept of Lag BaOmer in Meron, as it relates to this week's Parsha. Seemingly, there should be no connection, because the first part of the Parsha discusses the laws regarding the Kohanim, the priests, and restrictions that are placed on the Kohen. And there are other things that come up along the way, and then the second part of the Parsha emphasizes the holidays. It's like Bomer is not even really, it's a very late holiday. It's simply the 33rd day of the Omer, and according to one tradition, it was the day upon which the students of Rabbi Akiva, perhaps soldiers in Bar Kokhba's revolt, stopped dying in the wake of a plague that affected them. So what does this have to do with going to the grave of Shimon Bar Yochai? I'll tell you what the connection is. It's a very interesting thing. The celebration, historically speaking, the celebration of the 33rd day of the Omer in Meron is a relatively late development. It's very, very intimately connected with the center of Jewish mysticism in Tzfat, which is literally right next to Meron. And the truth of the matter is, it really only starts taking off in the 17th, 18th century. In fact, there's a famous responsum of Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chatam Sofer, who flourished in the first half of the 19th century, who hears about what goes on in Meron with the lighting of the bonfires and stuff like that. And he really doesn't really understand what's going on there. He can't figure out, that he doesn't understand what significance there is. It shows you it's a relatively new thing. However, just because something is new doesn't mean it's illegitimate. And just because something is new doesn't mean that it is totally new, that it doesn't draw on earlier things. The various elements that make up the observances at Meron actually date deep into the Middle Ages, if not earlier. The idea of visiting Kivrei Tzadikim, of going to the graves of righteous people or famous righteous people, is documented all the way back into the Second Temple period and possibly in biblical times. The idea of burning of lighting fire or lighting candles at such a place is documented at least deep in the Middle Ages, not in Meron, but in the reputed kever of Shmuel HaNavi in Navi Samuel near Pisgat Zev. I'm sorry, near Gibat Zev. The idea of marking the yort site, or the idea that the yort site of Reb Shimon Bar Yochai falls on Lag BaOmer, the idea spreads again. It's at least 400 or 500 years old. There are those who will argue that perhaps it's based on a misreading of the Zohar, but all of that is all of that's irrelevant. The question that really needs to be asked is, why do people go to holy places. What is it? And that's the connection to our parsha, because our parsha, like the parsha leading up to it, Achrimot and Kedoshim, deals with sanctity. It deals with holiness. And we, and Jews, the Torah teaches us to, we ourselves should be holy. And that, and our Torah, it's our, the two major foci of this week's Parsha emphasize the importance of Kedusha in our relation to it. In the case of the Kohanim, it's the charisma of the Kohen as a person who is Kadosh, as a person whose own deportment and family life and persona should evoke Kedusha, should broadcast Kedusha, should broadcast sanctity and holiness. And the, what are the holidays? The holidays are sanctification of time, period of time, whether it's a week, whether it's a day, in which time and experience are transformed, in which a person is enveloped in sanctity. It requires preparation. One marks the beginning of a day, for Shabbat, for example, by saying Kiddush. One marks the end of the day by saying Havdalah. In other words, holiness comes up to here, but not beyond that. And Shabbat, for example, embodies more than one aspect of this idea of being surrounded by holiness. It also emphasizes or also exemplifies the fact that sanctity is magnetic. Sanctity is attractive. Rav Soloveitchik always used to say that Jews are hypnotized. Jews are absolutely ineluctably drawn to sanctity, to holiness, because holiness is an expression of godliness, of God's presence in the world. When we go into Shabbat, so Shabbat brings us into a realm of godliness, which according to Chazal, the days of the Mashiach, the time of the Messiah, will be a period in which Shabbat just keeps going, because we will have been transformed in terms of our being, in terms of our existence. And the same is true of the holidays. And the same is true of the Beit HaMikdash. So if the holidays and Shabbat are sanctity in time, then the temple is sanctity of place. Those of us who have the privilege of going to Har HaBayit, going up to the place where the temple stood, and we believe that the sanctity of the temple of the Beit HaMikdash is still evident there. That's why we have to go to mikveh, and you have to be careful the places you don't go, and so on and so forth. No, one insight about holiness, which underlies the entire idea, but I think it's most obvious in Har HaBayit, and at least as a start. And that is that sanctity is something that you experience, but is indescribable. It is something that you know. It is something that you internalize. It's transformative, but it goes beyond the cognition or the communications ability of the individual. It is, as Rudolf Otto, the famous philosopher of religion, would have said, it is something numinous. It's indescribable, but is no less real. And you know it's authentic because you're there. And you are drawn to it because it's authentic. You're drawn to it because it's a place to commune with godliness in this world. Now, that's true. It's true that God is everywhere. But nevertheless, for our benefit, I think, the Torah prescribes that there be days that we withdraw emotionally from our quotidian behavior, our daily behavior, and immerse ourselves in sacred time, and also, when we merit the existence of the temple, to be drawn into sacred space. We have something of that experience when we go into a synagogue, or we go into a Beit Midrash, because there too, these places are imbued with numinous atmospheric sanctity, which is projected, and which we can, which we then receive in our sort of kedusha receptors, if you want. Now, the truth of the matter is that because of the sensitivity and being drawn to sanctity, the practice developed over the years that Jews would also seek out people who inspired them, who radiated godliness. Not because they are God for, you know, Halila, God forbid, God or angelic or angels or anything of that sort. We only worship God. We don't believe in intercessory prayer, and anybody who prays for intercession is really making a mistake. Nevertheless, there are people in our lives, or people in our imaginations, or people of whom we've learned, who are no less real in our lives after they are no longer physically here than when they were alive. And going to the place where they are, in the case of, say, righteous people, buried, is a way of having more tangible contact with them and communing with their memory in a way more forceful than perhaps doing only in one's imagination. That creates that's why people are drawn to Kivrei Tzadikim, because the charisma of their memory draws them there. It's not the bones, it's not the graves, it's the persona and the identity of their stories and the teachings of a person with a specific place. Now, what makes this possible is the typically Jewish position on time. What do I mean by time? I mean that, again, as Rav Soloveitchik says on many occasions, and here he sort of comes together with all kinds of religious anthropologists, so for those of you who need academic verification of what I'm saying, that the Jewish sense of time, aside from being late, right, the Jewish sense of time is one in which the past is never dead. The past is always alive. There's recent past and there's distant past, but they're always accessible. That's why when we study Torah, all of the figures, all the people whose stories we tell or whose insights we learn, we study, are with us at the time. We always say Rambam says, Rashi says, Jacob did. Jacob's doing this. He's not. It's very immediate. It's very tangible. That being the case, that so if you put that together in light of that, let's put it that way, in light of that, when you go to visit the grave of a person whose life and teachings you're intimately intimately familiar, somebody who has an impact on you, whether you can even meet him, being in the place where whatever physical is left of that person is there, is a moment of communion with the memory and the teachings of that person, and that puts off a certain, gives off a very serious sense of sanctity, and that's the draw. You want to derive inspiration from that person. You want to remember that person. We do this with members of our family. God forbid somebody dies, you go once a year to the cemetery and you remember them. Not only you don't remember them all the time, but there's something more powerful. Because if you're talking about a person whose personality was sacred, then you're basically simply being drawn by the kedusha of their personality. Now the poskim are very, very emphatic that again, you don't go and pray to the saint. We don't think that we have to turn to anybody but God. Nevertheless, and many of us, don't really draw drawn in that direction. I'm not saying it about me personally. I feel very strongly this idea of timelessness and the personality of the people of a person whose grave I might encounter. But there are many people for whom this is very meaningful. It's a meaningful religious moment. And the fact that the grave of Rav Shimon bar Yochai, who was both a national as well as a mystical as well as a Talmudic hero, draws people, says much about the religious and spiritual needs and aspirations of the people that go. Yes, I'm sure many go just for the party because it's a thing, it's a happening. But that's not the whole story. It's not the whole story. The story is it's an opportunity to be able to have a profound religious experience in their terms. And this has nothing to do with what happened yesterday, of course. All of the authorities and the police and everyone will check out to see why this horrible thing happened and which took as of right now 45 lives. But one thing I think we need to do is to be extremely respectful of the very basic religious draw which magnetized and drew these people to those people who went to Meron on Lag BaOmer to celebrate the life and the figure and the persona of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and the entire mystical tradition with which he's attracted. That's the issue here. It fulfills a genuine need among people, because again, sanctity is numinous. God, in his wisdom, and we see this in the Parsha, has allowed holiness to be expressed in time. Go describe Shabbos to somebody, right? All they said, many people who have never experienced Shabbos just see the restrictions, not the atmosphere, because the atmosphere is intangible, and atmosphere is indescribable. Why it's like the famous Gemara, Tavlin Echad Yeshlanu V'Shabbishma, that we have a spice in the food which is called Shabbos. Again, you can't describe what something tastes like. Similarly, sanctity of place is formative, it's tangible, but it's indescribable. The same is true of the satisfaction of eating kosher or all the other things that were, or of leading a moral, sexually moral life, which is what another part of Kedusha is about, or living a moral life and doing the right thing and even making sacrifices to do the right thing for a person. All of this is part of sanctity because all of this is imitating God. And I think if we have anything to take away from this horrible tragedy from yesterday, it is that we should, of course, do the godlike thing and take care of ourselves and be healthy and make sure that not be prodigal with human life, but also that we should try to increase the amount of sanctity we put in our lives, and in our space, and in our time. Let's hope for a better week next week. Shabbat Shalom.